this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 11, and today I'm joined by Christopher Johnstone, who is Associate Professor of Communication Arts and Sciences here at Penn State. His research and teaching focuses on the history of rhetorical study, or rhetorical theory, rhetorical criticism, and the philosophy of rhetoric. He specializes in the development of Greek rhetoric, and so will add to our ongoing discussion of the relationship between rhetoric and philosophy in the classical period. His recently completed book will appear in November 2009 from the University of South Carolina Press, entitled Listening to the Logos, Speech, and the Coming of Wisdom in Ancient Greece. He's also written numerous articles on ancient Greek rhetoric and communication, including the essay on which we'll focus some of our discussion today, entitled Sophistical Wisdom, Politikē Arete, and Logosophia, which appeared in Philosophy and Rhetoric in 2006. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Christopher Johnstone, to the Digital Dialogue.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we talked a little bit before about this sort of questioning the relationship between the philosopher and the sophist. But before we maybe do that, maybe you could talk a little bit about this article and its relationship to your upcoming book and what your book is going to be about.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. I mean, this article is based on part of one chapter in the book. The chapter in particular focuses on sophistical wisdom and Socratic wisdom, mm-hmm. and seeks to explore the both the similarities and the contrasts between the sophists and Socrates within the larger context of the book, which is looking at the nature of wisdom, its various conceptions and the terms that were used to articulate and describe it, and the relationship between these various conceptions of wisdom and logos and its various incarnations. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as a rhetorician, I'm going to focus on logos as speech and argument, right. and reasoning, but mm-hmm. Because of the folks that I looked at, and from Homer through the pre-Socratics and the sophists and Socrates and into Plato, Isocrates, and Aristotle, mm-hmm. Looked at a broader conception of logos as well. And
so in what sense, I mean, I know in the article that you talk a little bit about, you gesture a little bit to that larger history, the longer relation between sort of what's happening with the sophists as they come out of this pre-Socratic exactly. movement. How are you conceptualizing that development?
And again, it's real hard to draw hard and fast lines between these things. And I discovered certainly in the course of my research for this project that when you look at the pre-Socratics as a group right. and try to distinguish them, say, from the sophists, when you get to people like Democritus, for example, he is not just describing the natural world or generating a theory for describing the natural world, but also talks about kind of moral principles and right. and the life well lived and so on. Pythagoras the same way. Mm. So when I look at the pre-Socratics, I see a preoccupation with what has come to be called natural philosophy, but an explanation of world events in a nature-centered rather than a theocentric mm-hmm. mode mm-hmm. of discussion. I would characterize the sophists in contrast to that tradition that they inherited mm-hmm. as focusing on a different realm of our experience rather than the natural realm, why do the planets move the way they do, what causes earthquakes and eclipses and so on, about the nature of the social and mm-hmm. Epistemological human being. Mm-hmm. How do we know what we know? What do we know? What can we know? What is the life well lived? What are the virtues and excellences we ought to cultivate? What is the nature of virtue? Mm-hmm. Because I think of a particular epistemological stance that we can identify with sophistical teachings generally, and I don't want to mm-hmm. over, and you know through right. reading the article, I want not to overgeneralize or right. paint all these folks with right. the same brush and so on, but I've tried to distill what I see as essential qualities here, but as a kind of epistemological skepticism and a kind of ontological skepticism. If we take, for example, Gorgias's three theses, really seriously, not just as a jab at Parmenides and, right. and so on, but as an articulation of a genuinely skeptical stance on things. Right. There are no absolutes or universals or objective realities outside our perceptions. He might be taken to say in his first thesis, and even if there were, we couldn't know what they were, or that they were, and even if we could know them, we couldn't communicate them to another person, and so on. Well, I think, you know, that sort of stance problematizes a lot of the ways in which the pre-Socratic thinkers had gone about the process of thinking about knowing and inquiry and so on. So I think that was the kind of point of departure.
Right.
A focus on the social and the moral realm much more so than the pre-Socratics, and an interrogation of and kind of critical stance with respect to that body of, I'll call it proto-philosophical literature.
But I mean, in that sense, and this will be interesting to hear more about the relationship between the Sophists and Socrates. Of course, I'm assuming that we're talking about the Sophists as if they're one, you know, group of people, which we agree, I think, and you make the point in your article, and I think the people who are doing the work in on the rhetoric side of this are always very sure to insist that, you know, we can't just paint all the Sophists with the same brush. But I think it'll be interesting to think a little bit more about how, as I mentioned to you earlier, that a certain story gets told about what the Sophists are doing, and that story depends on a certain kind of story about what the philosophers were doing, the pre-Socratic philosophers in this sense.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I'm really interested in, as you explain this, it's sounding very much to me like Socrates' second sailing in the Phaedo, where he says, those guys were worried about Phusis, and I actually am turning to what's the second best, which is looking at logos and looking at the human in this context.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how. I mean, are you intent on separating Socrates from Plato or in that regard, or do you want to? How do you want to read Plato in that?
Well, let me back up for a second.
Yeah, sure.
First of all, I think that one of the things that Socrates shared with the Sophists, his fellow 5th century intellectuals in Athens, was a general disinterest in the natural philosophy, the naturalistic inquiries that preoccupied the pre-Socratics.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes, I think, the same kind of stance that many of the Sophists do. We can't know about that. In any case, they're competing theories. None of them is any necessarily more compelling than another. In any case, there is this other that really is pressing. What is the nature of the good life? What should be grounding our choices? So I see him and the Sophists as still as interested in very the same kinds of things.
Right.
The nature of moral knowledge, the question about the methods of inquiry by which that knowledge can be obtained, and of course they deviate in their answers to those questions, but I think what brought them together was that kind of an interest. Of course, then the Sophists and Socrates differ, I think, in really with respect to the ontological and epistemological skepticism that I identify with the Sophists.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, they sort of said there aren't any such moral absolutes out there. Even if there were, we couldn't know them. And even if we could know them, we couldn't articulate them to another. I think Socrates' basic position is there must be such moral absolutes.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, they can be known by the rational human intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And as known, they can be articulated in the form of true definitions of moral terms, justice, love, beauty.
Yeah. I mean, I think, just to interrupt for a second, because I think this is where our discussion will get interesting, because I think there's certainly, I mean, there's a lot now of new scholarship coming out about Plato, which is taking this dramatic, you know, the fact that he wrote in dialogue form very seriously on all the dramatic dimensions, and therefore is perhaps, Plato himself is perhaps much more attuned to the embedded contextual conditioned nature of human knowledge than I think a caricature of Platonism might otherwise suggest. And so if we read Plato as putting Socrates in certain kinds of dramatic situations precisely because he's recognizing the contingent nature of all attempts to articulate what the good and the just is, then we have I think a different picture of what Plato himself was worried about, and even I think Socrates. And I would go all the way with you, I think, until the point where you suggest that Socrates is committed to the idea that the good or the just or the beautiful can really be defined in a way that can be possessed and fully articulated by human beings.
Okay, well, but so let me back up.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I kind of laid it the track, but I want to say, I think Socrates is different from Plato in the sense that he is somewhat more skeptical about the possibility of human knowledge. Now, I sort of, in contrast to the Sophists, and in kind of his conversation with them, I think what he is hoping is that there are such moral absolutes and that they can be known and articulated. So what I really see him doing, and I'm talking about the Socratic Socrates as opposed to the Platonic Socrates.
Okay.
And I sort of take that based on my reading of the early dialogues, which I see the mission of which, or Plato's purpose in which, being different from what goes on in his middle and later dialogues.
Okay.
And so I kind of make a distinction there in terms of understanding the historical Socrates. But anyway, I see him as an interrogator, not advancing knowledge claims of his own, indeed expressing a certain kind of dubiousness about whether these things can be known.
Right.
But it's kind of, I almost get a sense of an act of faith on his part, but that we must believe. It's like, Henry James, you know, not Henry James, William James, that, you know, that we believe in moral principles because we must to, and we must do so in order to live the lives that we want to live.
Right.
That have to lived in terms of something.
Right.
So we choose those moral principles that, you know, it becomes an act of faith there too. And I think Socrates was hopeful but not sanguine about the possibility of humans ever getting there. So I think I understand what you're getting at.
Yeah.
What Plato does, I think, is to pick up where he sees Socrates having left off and doesn't share the kind of dubiousness or skepticism that even Socrates has about the possibility of humans knowing that. I don't think Socrates doubted the existence of those truths.
Uh-huh.
I think that he was not sure about whether humans could ever actually apprehend them.
Right. Well, I guess, I mean, and this is probably part of a larger discussion. So, I mean, for my part, I would want to argue that actually Plato, that the Platonic Socrates that we get in the dialogues, and I wouldn't want to necessarily yet distinguish between early, middle, and late, because I'd rather read the dialogues in their from sort of starting with the Parmenides maybe and reading in the dramatic form
kind of historical
chronology. Saying, you know, any attempt to distill Platonic thought from those dialogues is problematic.
Platonic or Socratic?
The Platonic doctrine from the dramatic dialogues, right? So I'm not necessarily thinking about, you know, Xenophon and the historical Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of separate question for me. My interest is really using the Platonic dialogues to try and discern something about this character Socrates and what he's teaching us.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to resist this temptation to distill from that a Platonic doctrine straight away, because I think when you take seriously the dramatic style in which these things are written, you come away with a lot less of the robust theory of forms, and knowledge has to be absolute, and there is this absolute separation of the forms from the appearances.
Mm-hmm.
You have Socrates introducing these ideas in contexts that make sense maybe for the specific context, but are always have to be brought back to that dramatic context. And there's a way in which Plato, I think, in choosing the style of the dialogue, insists upon that all the time, when saying, look, I chose not to write my philosophy in that sense. But this actually brings me to another side of this, which is I wonder what you would make of the move from orality to writing, which is really what distinguishes Socrates from Plato in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Socrates doesn't write, but Plato does. And so there's a danger, and there's a dangerous side of that writing that Plato, I think, himself realizes. If maybe we could go back, just because I think the crucial thing from my perspective is that difference between Socrates' attitude toward what he calls the forms, or toward the good or the just, and I'm thinking just in terms of the dialogues, not in terms of historical Socrates, and let's say somebody like Protagoras or somebody like Gorgias' attitude to those absolutes. And thinking with regard to the nature of Socratic politics and the project that I'm trying to work through a little bit is that Socrates sees the real social and political power of turning people to consider the good and the just and the beautiful without necessitating that they be definable and capturable fully in human epistemic knowledge. Does that make...
Well, I have to say, I think that it's hard for me to respond because I have to make a distinction between the different Socrateses that are even present in the dialogue.
Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah,
so
sure.
When you're talking about Socrates, I see at least two different Socrates presented in the dialogues.
Okay.
And I do make the distinction in terms of those who were earlier in mm-hmm. Plato's career and then the ones that came in the middle and the later things, because I think that the
Well, when Socrates disappears altogether, right?
Well, exactly, right. By the time you get to the laws.
Yeah.
But the early dialogues, the Gorgias is among those, for example, are almost... maybe all of them are aporetic. That is to say, they mm-hmm. don't result in any kind of answers to the questions. Euthyphro is another
right,
example.
Sure.
They just never get to the answer, and the conversation breaks off, and so on. I think that those dialogues are much truer to the historical Socrates' attitude mm-hmm. toward questions of knowledge and mm-hmm. Moral truth and so on,
right.
Because I don't think he claimed to have reached that himself. And you may recall,
right.
In fact, I make a point of this in my discussion of Socrates in the book here. The moment in the symposium when Diotima is mm-hmm. talking to Socrates as being recounted
right.
and so on and so forth, where she is explaining the kind of ascent toward the true knowledge of beauty and such, and lays out the kind of the initial stages and says something to the effect of, and I think even you, Socrates, might have gotten to this level,
mm-hmm, right,
and then
right,
going on.
Right.
And number of scholars, and I find this persuasive myself, number of scholars identify that moment as a Plato's kind of noting or marking where his teacher had actually come to. There were no positive doctrines of mm-hmm. Socrates himself mm-hmm. that got put forth.
Right.
And so what I see in, when we were calling Socrates of the dialogues,
yeah.
is Socrates as the voice of Plato's own developing and maturing thought over mm-hmm. the course of, again, Plato's a historical person, and
yeah.
so stuff happened to him,
right.
and I think his thinking about some of those issues changed over the course
sure.
of his life, especially after the sort of
yeah.
disasters the disaster in Syracuse,
right,
when he
right.
was imprisoned and all
right.
this kind of business.
Right.
I think he became real disillusioned with a kind of idealism that really was at the heart of something like the Republic, for example.
Yeah. And I understand that. I mean, I guess my problem, and there's a whole, there's a longer discussion to have about whether we can take Socrates as a mouthpiece in the sense for Plato, because, I mean, I think it's sort of like taking, Hamlet as a mouthpiece for Shakespeare. I mean, we just wouldn't do that. And you do it because you think Plato, he's a philosopher, and philosophers are supposed to do certain kinds of things. But if we take him seriously as a literary philosopher and take those dramas as dramas, we have to wonder if we can just say, well, Socrates is the voice of Plato in a certain kind of respect. I like this idea. I'd have to look more about this symposium passage. I like this suggestion, although I would say that Diotima herself says at the very height of the latter, if such a thing were possible for human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So she still holds it open. And if we could even consider her the voice of Plato, I don't know. But Plato constructs these wonderful dialogues in order for us to, be thrust into these kinds of contexts and for us to think about it in those ways. And what this actually maybe brings us back to the question of what are the sophists doing and what are philosophers doing if we don't caricature the philosopher as simply, obsessed with, which some of us are, obsessed with the absolute truth and the belief that that's possible for humans, or at least animated by that dream.
Yeah, let me go back to that,
because
I think it's an important issue. And you mentioned before, as we kind of talked early on, or maybe before we started recording, but
mm-hmm.
at any rate, the distinction between the sophist and the philosopher.
Yeah.
And you kind of mentioned something, people in my field
yeah.
have been certainly examining that kind of that question in the work of the sophist pretty extensively over the last couple, 3 decades now,
right.
I guess. And I would say that at least one position that's taken by scholars in my field, and again, is one that I take, is that the distinction between the sophists and the philosophers is a false distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 reasons. I mean, one is, I think it's anachronistic. And
right.
so you read the work of Ed Schappa, for example,
mm-hmm.
Who is very vehement about resisting or avoiding anachronism. And he talks about predisciplinary
right.
readings of texts, especially of the sophists, especially of the pre-Socratics. And this is kind of one of the themes of my book, too,
mm-hmm.
that we're looking... philosophy per se, philosophia,
right.
que rhetorici,
mm-hmm.
didn't come into being, in the case of rhetoric, in the Gorgias,
right.
in the early 4th century. Philosophia appears in Pythagoras
right.
and... But it's not a central thing. And even in someone like Isocrates, you know, a kind of fourth century thinker, he doesn't use the word rhetoric in his treatises or, you know, writings, whatever, teachings, but rather philosophia as a kind of package of study that embraces the art of the speaker.
Right.
Rhetoric-y. So there, that's one thing I would say, is that the distinction in terms of the 5th century is anachronistic, so we really can't make that decision.
Right.
The second thing, and this is really, I think, what people like Schappa and others in my field who have investigated this office would say, is they are doing philosophy.
Yeah.
What they're doing is a different kind of philosophy. It is not the kind of metaphysical, well, it is metaphysical if you take those the three theses as a kind of commentary, a metaphysical commentary, meaning that if the metaphysicians are looking for an absolutely objectively existing universal reality, there ain't no such thing.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Now, that itself is a kind of philosophical doctrine.
But I mean, Xenophanes, for example, when he says, you know, we can't know the truth, but we can discover better, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, Xenophanes, of course, he's always, whether he's a philosopher or a religious thinker or whatever, everybody's, you know, that's a debate. I think that's a false debate. So what I'm actually interested in, I'm really on board, and you've shown me a lot, you've pointed me into a lot of great literature, Schappa's one, and Susan Jarrett, and other kinds of people, rereading this office. I think that's great. That's exactly what needs to be done. But like with, for example, with Susan Jarrett's work, there's a caricature of Plato. There's a caricature of Aristotle in that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way in which at least my reading of Plato, my reading of Aristotle, is much closer to what I think you're trying to advocate for the sophists,
mm-hmm.
namely a sensitivity to human finitude, a sensitivity to the relationship between Sophia and Phronesis, for example.
Exactly.
And how those two play on each other.
Exactly.
And I worry that we get into a kind of anachronism when we, first of all, separate you over in communications and I'm over here in philosophy,
mm-hmm.
and we don't get to have these kinds of conversations and really think about, well, I think we had this similar kinds of interest, and if we could get rid of the caricature of each other, could we reconsider what that relationship even back then might have been like, and where, why maybe, you know, and Schappa, I think, makes some good points about Plato using the Gorgias and just trying to establish rhetorike as something that's, you know, definitive and,
mm-hmm.
and comes to be what it is, and then legitimate philosophy as a pursuit. So I think all that is really important to think about. We have a common student, Pam Dorian. She's in both of our classes.
She's taking my intro to rhetorical theory course?
And she's taking my ancient Greek philosophy, and she just blogged about.
She's seen some really interfaces there. Yeah, that's cool.
And I'll point you to the blog. I'll post the blog on this for the podcast, too, where she's using the text that you're doing to get us to think about, in a less dogmatic way, about the sophists. Because Socrates, we're reading the Protagoras right now, Socrates does set us up to think about the sophists in a certain way when he's talking to Hippocrates in that sort of middle frame part, not the absolute frame where
mm-hmm.
he's talking to a friend, but when he's talking to Hippocrates, he says, Hippocrates, you got to watch out for these sophists, you know, they mesmerize you and all this stuff. So he's setting us up in a way, and we've bought into that, I think, you know, generations of us have bought into that. But the way Protagoras himself is depicted, really depicted in the dialogue, is not necessarily that caricature that even Socrates
exactly
does.
So, and that's true of Gorgias and the Gorgias too.
Exactly.
You think about it, the really antagonistic voices in the Gorgias are Polus and Callicles,
exactly.
Right? And so
or caricatures already.
Yeah,
of Gorgias,
yeah, exactly
right?
So, exactly
yeah.
So. So even Plato does the caricature,
exactly.
You know, because he's got a project. And I would say, by the way, about Susan Jarrett's book, and she's not alone in this. Is her rereading and refiguring, you know, of the sophists, I think it was deliberately done from a particular standpoint,
right.
A kind of feminist theory and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for one might almost want to say dramatic purposes, the caricature works in the same way they did
for
Aristophanes, you know?
So I want, but so then from my interest is really in thinking about, okay, what's at stake or maybe there's something important to be thinking about in terms of, you know, the way things get legitimated. You know, you have to legitimate yourself, you have to caricature the other, and that, I think, is problematic from the perspective of one of the things I'm trying to think about is political dialogue and the possibility of
mm-hmm.
dialogue. Can
mm-hmm.
you have discussions that are genuine without, you know, we're minimizing caricature.
Well, I think it's a really interesting question. This is exactly, as it happens, what I'm talking about now in the rhetorical theory
mm-hmm.
course, because I have just talked about the sophists, I have just talked about Plato's critique of the sophist, uh-huh. sophistical rhetoric, and being a sham art and so right. on. And on next week, we'll be looking at Plato's offering of the path to a true art right. in the Phaedrus. Right. And what I'm sort of trying to do there is to point out what really is a distinction between two diametrically opposed views of the nature of things.
Mm-hmm.
One that is rooted in a belief in the existence of objective realities, in particular of moral realities, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking Plato this way,
mm-hmm.
And that they can be known by the human intellect and okay. so on, and a sophistical stance that rejects that assumption
mm-hmm.
and sees everything as problematic, that nothing is certain. Mm-hmm. We've got certain knowledge, we've got probable right. knowledge. Plato rejects
right.
probabilities, any kind of knowledge at all. The embrace of opinion on the sophist side is the only kind of knowledge we can have is belief or opinion.
Mm-hmm.
The rejection of doxa by Plato
right.
in favor of episteme and so mm-hmm. on. And I think in contemporary politics, I mean,
right.
take it this direction,
sure.
what we're seeing is this is, in a way, I don't want to oversimplify this, but, you know, the conflict between today's conservatives and today's liberals.
Right.
The conservatives believing that there's an absolutely true reading
right.
of the Constitution.
Right.
There are, in fact, they're
right.
totally, you know, upset about the possibility of relativism and so on and so
right.
forth. And then the progressive or pluralist, you
sure.
know, and so on, who says there are different truths for different people,
right.
and there are different ways of accessing that truth, and there's no one right, true way to read the Constitution or Scripture
right.
or whatever it might
right.
be. And never the twain shall meet,
right.
one wants to say,
right.
you know, because the starting points are so different.
And that's why I think this is really an interesting point when we go back and look at this division between sophistry and philosophy. Because, I mean, isn't it the case that that's a false dichotomy, this objective versus subjective, this, you know, relativism versus absolutism? That's just a false dichotomy. We are situated human beings. That the sophists knew, they understood, they affirmed that. But maybe, and this is the thing where I think Socrates, the dramatic figure Socrates, has a powerful point to make, which is that, look, even if we can't know these, even if we can't fully articulate them, if we orient our life toward them, the good, the just, what it is, even the very asking of the question is already bringing us on the way,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's where I think I see the power of Socratic politics being, not necessarily that we will possess and then deploy knowledge, possess knowledge and deploy it on, but search for it with the fully recognizing that we won't be able to possess it in the way we might dream of, but it's just the moving toward it that's already orienting a life in the right direction.
It sounds like John
yeah.
Dewey.
Yeah. You know, it, well, right.
You know,
is it
he
not,
talks
not
about
a
the virtue
sure.
being the direction of movement as opposed to the plane of rest.
Exactly. And here, though, in this, I wonder what you think about this, because I'm playing with this idea, and I don't know if I'm just off my rocker on this one. Protagoras, in the Protagoras, articulates what he's doing exactly. That he articulates this. If we can move people a little bit toward the good, right? He doesn't use make them better people is what
mm-hmm.
he says.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't appeal to the abstract good,
right?
But still, that is I think what you should be affirmed about what the sophists were doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I think is affirmed by the really wonderful I think articulation of sophistical wisdom that you articulate in this essay, which is linked to the moment, has a sense for the what's proper or fitting for the situation, right? All these things you talk
mm-hmm.
about at the end that
mm-hmm.
that you associate with logosophia. So I don't know. I wonder if we give up that caricature of the opposing forces if we can't find our way into the middle where human existence really
yeah,
is.
Yeah, well,
right?
And I don't want to paint these as caricatures
sure.
at all, but I, you know, in terms of the most extreme forms,
yeah.
and there are on this kind of ideological
right.
or philosophical spectrum in our own contemporary moment
right.
society,
sure. Sure.
there certainly are.
Sure. Well, that means I get to be
kind of
associated, the philosophers get associated
yeah.
with the far right wing. I don't know if I like this so much.
Well, not depends on how you can see philosophy.
Sure, exactly.
Because you know, if you're
right.
a pluralistic philosopher,
right.
I.e. a sophist, you know.
Right, right. Okay, fair enough.
Then, you know, it's a different kind of philosophy.
Right.
It may put you in opposition to Plato
yeah.
and being a Platonist,
right.
Who, you know, does in fact embrace the idea, I think, of their existing absolutes that they
right.
can be known. And, You know, I tell you, there's literature in my field that goes back, you know, a couple, three decades that has called Plato a fascist.
Sure. That's actually the literature that I think I would like to just emphasize, is there's a number of things coming out that have come out also in the past 10 or more than, well, probably since the late 70s or so, in Plato scholarship that takes this dramatic stuff a little bit more seriously, questions who speaks for Plato, whether it's Socrates, or you can't take Socrates as a mouthpiece. A lot of stuff that we're doing in the Ancient Philosophy Society, where we're trying to think about Plato not as this dogmatic totalitarian type of figure, but actually as someone who wrote in dialogues for very specific reasons, precisely because, or it was a way for him to articulate the contingent contextual nature of all of these discussions. Mm-hmm. And we philosophers lose when we distill those, when we distill the arguments, when we distill the doctrine, and Plato becomes Platonism, that we lose something. Yeah, in that. And so what I'm interested in is coming back to try to get some.
That's a really, I think, a really nice idea, because what's happened is that those dialogues, which you say, I think, were written in a spirit of kind of drama and kind of exploration and play, even the sense of being a play, almost a sophistical sense of play, as in Gorgias at the end of the Helen.
Exactly, you point out in this essay about that.
Yeah, I think that is a really nice way of understanding those things. And of course, what happens with any body of writings is they become canonized, and then they're, you know, and doctrinaire, and this happened with the early writings of the in the Christian church. Sure. When you get to the Council of Nicaea and so on and so forth, all of a sudden here's the truth about Christian teachings, and all this other stuff is somehow heretical. Right. I think that's sort of, I don't know if there's a heretical school of thought with respect to Platonism and Plato.
Yeah, sure.
But I think
there is. Well, and in fact, some of us in the Ancient Philosophy Society are feeling the wrath of being heretics, which I'm sure you feel that there's a certain way when, trying to rejuvenate the sophist, you're getting that too. And you may be getting it from some of the, we may be getting it from some of the same.
I think we're past that probably in my field, just because John Polaka started writing about the sophist back in the early 80s, 83, I think, was his sophistical definition of rhetoric essay. So I don't think any longer the whole project of trying to rehabilitate's the wrong word, but reinterpret and understand the sophists not as Plato's caricatures of them in the dialogues, but as thinkers in their own right.
It
goes back. Kerford did that. And Guthrie, I think. But at any rate,
Even Grote, you can go back to Grote he's trying to do
exactly.
something. So I think there is that. What I think was interesting, and this is maybe the first of multiple conversations we could have, because. If we can get out from under on both sides, the caricature on both sides, then maybe there's a way of seeing how these two kinds of intellectuals at that time in our history had a sensitivity to a kind of knowledge that didn't fall into this absolutism, relativism, or subjectivism, objectivism kind of dichotomy. And I think that's where politics is played out now, and it's something that I think we need to think about as a society. What is alluring about the objective, right? And what is disconcerting about this, this openness toward plural meanings?
Yeah, and again, as a way of bringing those things together, and it kind of brings to mind. Of the sophists that I studied in Erie, there are some, and Antiphon is the most prominent in my recollection right now. Who was not as skeptical nihilistic maybe as Gorgias is represented as being or is understood as being in terms of the three theses on nature and not being and so on.
Right.
And we don't have to get into the discussion there. I don't necessarily take that as representative of the historical Gorgias' views.
Right, okay.
But it does kind of posit some interesting starting points. Mm-hmm. But Antiphon. Posits and a conception of nature that he sets over and against nomos, and in fact the best thing, the good, becoming better, is that which corresponds to nature, which exists independently of nomos, of convention and law and belief and so on and so forth. And so in that respect, there is an objectively existing thing even for a quote-unquote sophist. For those in the more Platonistic orientation toward things looking for a you know, a solid foundation, some objectively existing real thing. Nature can do that as well. It certainly.
Well, and I think that, you know, it also encourages us to think a little bit more critically maybe about what we might understand to be a Greek naturalism, which is to say that, look, as natural beings, it makes some sense that our logoi belong to the way nature expresses itself to some degree, which is something different from saying we can have a full grasp of it or we can articulate it fully into logoi.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly what the chapter on the Pre-Socratics does. Okay. Before we get to the 5th century, and especially in the work of Heraclitus, I link the logos of the individual to the logos of the soul as the reason, and no deeper than which one can go to the logos of the cosmos as the principle of proportionality that governs the ebb and flow and the union of opposites and all that kind of stuff. Hence the title of the book, actually, Listening to the Logos, as you probably recognize, a take on Heraclitus, listening not to me but to the Logos, as wise to read it all things.
My book that's under consideration now is being reviewed, called The Saying of Things on the Nature of Truth and the Truth of Nature in Aristotle, is related to these issues. So maybe when that comes out and when your book is out, maybe we can have a session or two on those two texts and see and continue the dialogue.
I would enjoy that.
Thank you very much, Chris, for
My
coming
pleasure.
On the Digital Dialogue.
Appreciate it.